Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel. We are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Welcome. This is From the Holodeck. If you're new to our podcast, you can find all of our shows, past, present, and in the future, wherever you listen to podcasts, just search From the Holodeck. All right, so this is the Starfleet Academy edition. We plan to discuss and break down the entire first season of Starfleet Academy. Today, we begin with a discussion of the premiere episode titled Kids These Days. It's been said that a lot is riding on this series, and I would agree.
Yeah.
Particularly given the changes in attitude around current production trends over at Paramount Skydance, streaming is no longer viewed as the end-all it was once thought to be. For Trek to survive the strong currents of technological change and audience fragmentation, while also contending with the very real fact that Star Trek is an aging IP, Starfleet Academy must be a success, or at the very least, not a failure. Hopefully that doesn't sound incredibly hyperbolic, but that is something that Star Trek, the Star Trek gods over at Paramount do have to be, have to consider.
Have to be mindful about.
This has to be a breakout success for it to be justified past its already greenlit second season. Now, I have had trepidations and concerns going into this series, many of which were not so much assuaged after watching the first episode, as they were partially muted. So my initial thoughts are this. It's fine. It's not stellar. It's not groundbreaking, but I'm reasonably intrigued. Superficially, it is what all Star Trek should strive to be. Aspirational, aspiring to be better, self-overcoming through struggle, and the idea that through the complicated aspects of our lives, we find ourselves, yes. Right? And potentially the greatness within each of us. So the episode places emphasis on the virtues of youth, the notion of thinking differently than previous generations, of viewing conditions and scenarios through fresh eyes, in ways that older generations, perhaps as creatures of comfort drawn to the familiar, often cannot. So the core idea here is that for better or worse, youth inherit what is left behind by the previous generation. And this is presented as a positive, you know, which is an optimistic concept. It's anchored in the core Star Trek idealism, its liberal humanist message. So the bones, the framework are sound.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't feel like I've seen enough yet to say, yes, this series is a success. As I said, I had a lot of concerns going in. I wasn't very happy with what I saw in the trailer. It didn't really feel right. Now, many of those concerns, like I said, have not been assuaged, but they have been muted. David, initial thoughts.
My initial thoughts on Strange New Worlds on Starfleet Academy are pretty much in line with yours. I was going in with a little trepidation about Starfleet Academy after the trailer, but I was very happy as I was watching that if you pay attention to the details, everything makes sense. So like
the moving parts are there
and you're right. You do have some strong bones for this show to rely on. I was going in thinking that I was going to hate every single one of the new characters.
Mm-hmm.
But I walked away after after watching the first episode twice, I'm like, okay, these characters are not entirely fleshed out, but I am, as you put it, intrigued with them. I'm actually even in a better spot when I think about it with the main, who is Caleb. Caleb is our main character. And I'm in a better spot than him after one episode,
with
the
him?
Premiere with him.
Yeah.
Than I was with Burnham.
But, yeah.
But you get, now Burnham in the first episode was like, oof,
well, that was just
that was rough.
That was hard to swallow for a lot of Star Trek fans.
Yes. That was very hard to swallow
because of the whole mutiny thing.
But with Caleb, okay, I get it. I know your story. I can understand you as a character. And the best thing by far that I think in the first episode that I saw was if you pair up Caleb with older characters will not just learn off of Caleb, Caleb will learn off of them. And even like during the scenes where Caleb's with, I want to say Paul Giamatti's character, his character, how do you pronounce it?
Nos Braca.
Braca is like the scenes with him and Braca were cool. Like I really felt that tension with Braca and Caleb and Aki.
Okay.
So
when you were pleasantly surprised.
I was very surprised how I walked away from it. I said, you know, this actually could work.
Broadly, your thoughts seem very similar to mine. We went in thinking we're not going to like this, which very seldom we don't even do that. We don't like doing that.
I don't like doing
but
that.
But we both have spoken on our show that it's the first trailer I ever saw of Star Trek in the Kurtzman era that just didn't intrigue me. I'm like, well, this is concerning.
Yes.
And after watching it, I was intrigued, which is a success in my opinion.
In my opinion, yeah.
Like I said, the bones, the framework are sound. There's still a lot of work to be done, and I need to see a lot more before I say, yes, this is something I can definitively get behind. But I will say I'm far more intrigued after seeing two episodes than when I saw the initial trailer and that horrible, horrible fucking poster with the kids lying on their back smiling.
CW.
Like this is fucking Dawson's Creek.
Yes. Yeah. It was. And I was like, that's what I was worried about, Mike. That's what I was. Nobody forgets their first crew.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, please.
Yes.
No.
Oh, my God. No. Why did you have to repeat that tagline?
And it's like, no. I'm very happy that that poster does not.
So far,
the
trailer and the poster does not reflect what the show actually is.
I honestly think
so far
the PR person who came up with the trailer
should be shot
and the poster should be brought into a room and shot in the head.
Oh my God, David.
Because
all right, so let's get into this a little deeper. So upon first watch, I had a very similar feeling as when I first watched Deep Space Nine. It seemed like something different, which I liked. The producers of Star Trek must always attempt, in my opinion, to reinvent Trek. If it is to last, you can't go back to the well and make every series similar. You have to have the balls to go out on that tree limb.
Yeah.
And even if it breaks, you know, fall with that limb with grace.
Tried to fall with grace.
With class and grace, because that's really where real innovation happens.
Yeah.
Is taking those risks at doing different things. If Star Trek didn't take a risk, we wouldn't have had Deep Space Nine. So I am for the different. Whether this will become as great and as innovative as Deep Space Nine was, I cannot possibly know. I hope it does. It had the large ensemble like DS9, which at one point had like, what, 15 or more rotating characters?
Yes.
During the height of its run, creatively used at different times for different plotting and or narrative reasons. And it seems like we might be setting up something similar. And I'm for that. I really liked that we had our four core characters, seemingly, in the show, but then around them, we had another, it seemed like another 10 or 11 cast members.
Easily.
And I really enjoy that type of writing in Star Trek because look what it did for Deep Space Nine. Because when you have core characters like your four, your five, and then you have those rotating guest spots like Garrick and Gul Dukat and Nog, what you end up doing is you take familiar faces that we've also become emotionally invested in, and you're using them to substantiate and strengthen the stories of our core characters who we also are very much invested in. And what you have is this emotional interconnectedness between characters that pushes forward stories in ways that is very hard to do when you just introduce a new, fresh face for that week alone.
Yes.
And I am hoping they are going to utilize similar strategies with Starfleet Academy. I can't imagine they wouldn't, David, with the amount of faces that were introduced just in the first episode.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like that was the thing that really surprised me was like, I was expecting a feel like what I got in the first time of Discovery, where it was like you had your focus on Michelle Yeoh, Burnham, and not even Saru, I could say at that point, but like,
It was mostly about Burnham.
It was mostly about Burnham, and
the first season revolved around Burnham.
One of the biggest jokes that it actually even got played into the series was, you know, when Pike comes on and says, "I need names, give me names," and that we actually got the names of our crew down.
Yeah,
and I'm glad that Starfleet Academy didn't do that. We got a lot of characters to actually,
they put names to faces.
They put names to faces right away. And that was like going, yes, that's how you do it. That's how you do like what you alluded to with DS9. We get those characters right away because, and I think it's also because I'm hoping Kurtzman and his writing team have learned the lesson that because you guys have, you know, this adamant sticking point of sticking with a lesser episode count. Okay. You can't waste time then.
Yeah.
There's no time to waste. You need to introduce us to all the characters that you got and make sure that all those characters tie to your core.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that in the first episode, I got the vibe that our core is Holly Hunter's character, Paul Giamatti. And then, Caleb, but I want to remember the actor's name.
Sandro Rosta, I believe. That's how you say his name. But I agree with that, David. That was a huge surprise for me. And I was very thankful that it seems like, just based on the first two episodes, that the story is going to ultimately revolve around the relationship between Holly Hunter's Captain Nala and Rosta as
Caleb Mir.
That to me was something I was not expecting. Now, obviously there's going to be those episodes that veer away from that, but if you start your show like that, that usually is the foundation. That usually is the character building block of the show. The way they set it up, dealing with the back and forth, the somewhat resentment that Caleb Mir has towards the captain as well as Starfleet Federation. That's interesting. Those are things that you can do a lot with in terms of narrative. So I was pleasantly surprised that it wasn't just a show that highlighted, you know, youth angst and the daily lives of hormonal teens. I'm very happy that's not what the first episode showed. I really liked how the first episode was also presented. It was written similar to a feature film, almost like the programmers of old. You had the inciting incident, you know, Caleb separated from his mom. Then you had the first act concluding with Caleb being brought into Starfleet. And then you have all seemingly is lost when Braca attacks, which is the ending of the second act. Then the third act, the crew work together to push back the threat. I mean, for all intents and purposes, it was a mini movie, and it really felt like a mini Star Trek film because you even had the introduction of the USS Athena and the typical shuttle going towards the starship, and you get to see just how spacious and epic and grand the starship looks. I feel like Kurtzman respected the past without overly relying on it, or even going into those go-to tropes that we are very familiar, that we're familiar with from those typical first episodes. So it was a, I felt like it was Kurtzman exercising judgment, knowing how far he can push with certain things without it feeling too much like earlier forms of Star Trek, and making sure that this series starts off with its own unique signature. And in that regard, I do feel like this episode was, in fact, a success. It was basic, but it worked as a first episode. The levity seemed to aid and not disrupt the emotional stakes and narrative dilemmas. And you know, David, that I'm not a fan of comedy.
Yeah.
Like, I do like funny things, but I also feel like a lot of people think they're funny when they're writing, and you're not really that funny.
No.
And then the comedy just doesn't go over well. However, here, Dave, I felt like I was watching at times classic Star Trek movies where you have some of those comedic beats that work perfectly in tandem with the action and suspense. It brings down the stakes just a bit so we can remember to laugh and enjoy it, and then it brings it right back up.
Well, that's the thing that I thought I took away from the first episode that was really interesting. The play between Holly Hunter's character and Paul Giamatti's character.
I fucking loved it. Yeah, that's the best part, right?
You expected, especially for me when I came in, and I had very low expectations of this captain, Captain Nala, because like, why the fuck is she so laid back? Why is she like draped on her captain's chair like that? And it honestly annoyed some of Star Trek fans like of what a character is, but wait, I was
what?
Shocked.
It did what?
It annoyed a lot of Star Trek fans, her demeanor of like, is this really the captain that we're going to actually follow? And
because of her casualness.
Oh yeah. And like,
well, she's a hippie.
But the thing that I was really surprised with, she may be a hippie, but when it comes down to it, she can turn on the captain, the captain's switch.
Listen, we want our captains to be layered.
Yeah.
Like, we want them not to just be, I mean, even Picard in the first season, he was introduced as a very stern individual, but we learned very quick that he also was multi-layered.
And that's what I really thought was awesome with the scenes with her and Paul Giamatti, because that character playing off of Braca showed that no, she is a captain. Don't be fooled by basically like the hippiness of her attitude.
I was smiling, Dave. I was very, very happy when Paul Giamatti's Braca appeared on the bridge of USS Athena for the first time, and we had at least, what was it, like a 5-minute back and forth between the captain and Braca.
Yes.
And I'm just smiling because we have two Oscar contenders in Star Trek now getting paid what they're worth, like doing what they do.
Yes.
The amount of fun that I'm sure Kurtzman was having on, I believe he's the one who directed the first episode, the amount of fun he had to be having.
One of the things that I read about the behind the scenes that I thought was really interesting was like from the vantage point of the actor who plays Caleb, when he said in an interview that Sandro actually was talking about working with Paul Giamatti, he basically said it was an amazing learning experience for him.
I'm sure.
Because Paul Giamatti would actually work with him. He would actually, you know, if Sandro came up with an idea, Paul Giamatti said, okay, yeah, let's do it. Let's try it out. And you can see that type of chemistry being built in those scenes.
Yeah. I saw some people complaining about how Giamatti played Braca, that it was just way too over the top. And I couldn't disagree more.
No.
We've never seen an enemy like this before. He's unhinged.
Yes.
And having an unhinged villain in any series or movie usually serves the story well because they're unpredictable. You do not know what they're capable of. When you have a villain unhinged like Braca, You don't know when they're willing to just kill someone. Yeah. You don't know when they're willing to walk away. You don't know a lot about them because they're hard to understand. That's the nature of being unhinged.
Yes.
And that's why when he enters the scene, the stakes immediately rise because you don't know what to expect from this type of threat.
And what's cool is like, I think that's what really I took away from the character of Braca and the character of Captain Aki. You don't know what to expect from those two characters. They can be one way and then flip. And I think normally that might be a little strange and difficult to do, but it actually worked. It worked in this episode, seeing those type of characters play off of each other. I understand that people might think that, oh, he's channeling too much over the top of like his type of character. But I look at them and I say, you guys do realize how over the top some Star Trek villains have been. And one of the big complaints for a lot of Star Trek fans of Kurtzman is like, we don't have villains that basically are over the top, that are like a Khan, a Chang.
Yeah, I mean, if people think Brock is over the top, you're trying to tell me that Khan
is not over the top.
Was not over the top. The guy is a Shakespearean cartoon, but it worked.
It worked
so beautifully for Star Trek.
Look at
the melodrama of it all; just worked brilliantly.
Yeah, look at General Chang. General Chang's my favorite.
Same thing, spinning in his chair. I mean, come on, people forget things. They just want to complain without actually thinking for a moment. Wait a second, this is okay. We've seen these types of things before. This will work. They just are so quick to get mad. Everyone's so fucking angry, David.
Oh, yeah.
I'm so over it.
Over it.
So I also liked that the writers relied on their own histories, meaning everything from the Kurtzman era, the Burn being the actual catalyst that forces the Federation to shift their mission of exploration for a mission of survival, is now built into the DNA of this specific series. It's the catalyst by which we are introduced to certain failings of the Federation because of the Burn and because of the natural instinct to withdraw in order to protect oneself. So the Burn is a great diegetic historical moment that Trek can use as allegory for our own real world social, political, and economic failures. And this is also where some viewers felt like their own political affinities were under attack. One specific instance where some viewers felt attacked was the very premise of Caleb's characterization, the emotional matrix, the attitude, the idea that he was taken from his mother.
Yes.
As a young child, because his mother inadvertently broke the law that ended in the death of a Federation official, I believe is what it was.
Yes.
I mean, listen, when the captain, Holly Hunter's captain, said that there is no reason to ever take a child from his mother, I don't have a problem with that. I understand that certain political affiliations might say it is unfortunate, you know, that such a situation occurs, and ideally they should never happen, you know, meaning children being taken from their parents. However, the argument is that when immigration laws are not enforced, right, scenarios are created that place individuals in these difficult circumstances. So from this perspective, the laws are not just designed to keep potentially dangerous migrants from entering unlawfully, but also to prevent unnecessary risk, exploitation, and chaos within the system. So that's the justification when it comes to these attacks that people may feel are on their own political affinities and affiliations. But then from the Democrat side or the other political spectrum, the separation of children from their parents is viewed as a fundamental moral and humanitarian failure. Of government.
Yeah.
How is it so hard to understand that there's two ways of looking at such a situation, and that in this show, this particular character took the side that there should never be a reason why we separate a child from his parent? I don't feel like that is woke. I don't feel like that is divisive. It's simply stating a political stance for a character.
And it's a moral stance, too.
I feel like that's a very real story, right? Isn't that a very real world type of story.
Yeah. And that's the thing.
Political disillusionment. Isn't that what we're living in currently?
But that's the thing, is kind of like the character made a rational human reaction, which unfortunately for some people, rational human reactions don't exist. You either do one thing or the other, like some kind of robot. And it doesn't work that way.
No. And people might say, well, you know, okay, so the character said that, but you also know the writers are asserting their own ideology through this character. Okay. Well, regardless, you have to expect Star Trek to always take the more humanist approach to politics.
Yeah.
Culture itself has long been understood as the silent co-writer of Star Trek. Social reality and its struggles have consistently been refracted through a liberal humanist lens. This is not new. This is Star Trek.
Yeah.
It's what the franchise has always been. The more substantive issue, in my opinion, as Trek continues across decades, because there are issues that can, in terms of political affiliation, when we're talking about the liberal spectrum at large, the bigger issue when you're dealing with this ongoing IP, and this is something you and I have talked about at length, David, is the growing tension between the failures of real-world liberal humanism and newer ideological formations associated with the contemporary left. And as these latter frameworks increasingly dominate progressive cultural messaging, like we see in today's social climate, liberal humanism, which was big in the 60s, that's why Roddenberry was a humanist, mm-hmm. it risks being marginalized and displaced rather than developed in dialogue with them. So to me, that is the bigger issue here. Not that Holly Hunter's character was designed to express an ideological sentiment about what's happening today in the real world. It's whether or not that thought aligns with Star Trek's liberal agenda to begin with.
Exactly.
Which we don't know. We haven't seen enough. Yeah. Now, if this show goes down the route of Marxist and socialist thought, then I would say, well, listen, guys, you failed, because Star Trek cannot be written through the lens of socialist and Marxist thought. That's not Star Trek.
That's not Star Trek, because, I mean, there's a difference between socialism and liberalism. And I think that's the problem that I see a lot of people get confused with.
Yes.
That they...
They bunch it all together
like it's a freaking buffet of philosophy
or like political ideology,
where they can just pick and choose and say, this is everything. And you can't do that.
Yeah.
Because so many of those ideologies may seem similar, but they're all coming from different points of view.
Yes. And David, this is where some of my fears are more fully illuminated, and I'll flesh them out here, because the fear I have with the series, I'm not saying I'm afraid yet, but the fear that I may have down the road is that with the Caleb Mir setup, the situation with his mother in Starfleet, this can dangerously become a counter narrative, and counter narratives are broadly different in terms of liberal thought. And we've talked about this on our Critique Revolve shows. You know, counter narratives in cinema are typically films and TV shows, you know, where scenes or storytelling strategies that deliberately challenge, revise, or complicate dominant or widely accepted narratives by presenting alternative perspectives, experiences, and interpretations. So rather than reinforcing the prevailing ideological, cultural, or historical common sense, counter narratives expose what has been marginalized, oversimplified, or naturalized in mainstream storytelling. And Star Trek is not a counter narrative. Star Trek is articulated through a liberal humanist worldview, as I've been saying, enlightenment, rationality, universal human dignity, faith in institutions, not suspicion.
Yes.
Faith in institutions, reformed, not abolished. And then, of course, moral progress through reason, science, and cooperation. That's what liberal humanism is. And counter-narratives are distinctly not Star Trek. And what they're setting up with Caleb and the fact that, and we'll talk about this more when we talk about the second episode, when he says that the Federation is his enemy, that ruffles my feathers.
It does. I mean, even when his mother screams at him in the episode, don't trust the Federation.
Yeah, that's a slippery slope. You have to be careful.
It's a very slippery slope. Now, it was okay for me because, again,
it's her perspective.
It's her perspective as a character that just went through the burn.
Well, 100 years prior.
But yeah, 100 years prior. But like,
they're living the effects of the burn.
And yeah, I could understand a person screaming to her child, don't trust the Federation, because, you know, in their current situation, their lives suck because of that one incident. It didn't ruffle my feathers, but it, just like what you said with Caleb, when he makes that comment, it kind of gave me a pause in saying, are we going to go down this slope again? Because that is the one thing we can't do with Star Trek, is say that everything we know about Starfleet is wrong.
Yeah, well, exactly. Because that that changes the entire
premise.
Utopian premise.
There you go.
And you have to be careful. You can't do that. And I know that it's seductive for writers to want to do that, to push back on government, specifically younger writers. They really want to push back on government institutions and normative narratives. But the thing is that if you're writing for Star Trek, you got to understand Star Trek is liberal, not radical. It's humanist, not materialist. It's institutionalist, not abolitionist. It critiques racism, nationalism, authoritarianism, and militarism, but it rarely critiques the legitimacy of centralized authority.
Yeah.
Now, there are moments when Star Trek can bleed into those counter-narrative arenas. Mm-hmm. Discovery did it quite well by just utilizing the mirror universe.
DS9
used it by bringing in the Dominion, by fleshing out the story between Bajor and the occupation of Bajor via Cardassia. Mm-hmm. So there are ways to creatively do it, but you have to be very careful about making the Federation and Starfleet being the villain or seemingly this institution that is beyond repair and that you are suspicious of it. You have to be careful. Now, if they're trying to build trust between the institution and Caleb, between Federation, Starfleet, and Caleb, if that's the point, which they did use the word trust several times, and by the end of the season, we get to a point of understanding between the two, right? Between mm-hmm. Caleb and Starfleet, then I will be in good waters. But we have to be careful about these critiques. Can we all agree? Forget the real world politics for a minute. I mean, I think most humans can agree that the child unduly suffers.
Yes.
That's not what we're debating, right? We understand that that's not ideal for the child, and we can understand his perspective. So if you're trying to show subjectivity, then I'm all for it. So let's just make sure we're not taking broad strides at undermining the optimism of Star Trek.
I think that, and
I guess that could put it to rest, right?
Yeah, that's the biggest thing, is like, don't undermine the core values of Roddenberry's Star Trek.
All right, so a few miscellaneous things. I don't think I like the way the USS Athena looks yet.
Really?
Yeah,
I kind of dig it.
I feel like, okay, well, tell me what you liked about it.
The thing I liked about the USS Athena is the fact that it looks like a brand new ship.
Yes.
It looks like something that basically, yeah, I would picture the technology for ships would have changed.
Well, yes, 900 years in the future, 900 architecture is going to change.
Yeah. It baffled me, Mike. When I think about, and I love Discovery, I love the ship of the Discovery, I love like when we got to see some of the ships around Discovery's timeline. Yeah, they look great.
You're talking about future,
the Discovery future, or? The future Discovery.
Yeah. Well, they had futuristic
vessels. They had futuristic vessels. And that's why I was like looking at, after I saw that, I'm like going, okay, if you're going to introduce a brand new ship, give me something that we, that's unique. And when they do the whole shuttle thing with the Athena, I thought, okay, this actually looks legitimately like a futuristic Star Trek ship that could be thousands of years after,
yeah,
after the Enterprise.
Yeah. My issue is not that the ship looks totally different. I'm fine with, I think, David, you know, I'm fine with change. I think things should be different.
Mm-hmm.
I just wasn't sold on the, I guess they were like wings.
Yes.
For nacelles.
The nacelles, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very...
I don't know how I feel about that. Maybe it'll grow on me. You know, we'll see. Laura Thok, I believe is how her name was.
Yes.
Daughter of Amarit from the Klingon house of Dak Hattis and the Jem'Hadar lineage of Ka-Bah. I know I mispronounced all that, but guess what? They're not real words.
They're not real words.
So it's okay. This fixed many of the issues that I would have had with the Jem'Hadar. Now, I wasn't as worried as some. I know some people were saying, how are they going to describe the Femadar? We know that the Jem'Hadar were, I think they were all just one gender, right? I don't think it's a far leap to assume that they found a way to continue on without the founders 900 years in the future.
There are the key words that I'm going to use for this show.
900 years?
900 years.
A long time. Anything could happen, right?
Exactly.
To justify certain things.
Science is evolutionary. Okay. That's why I basically.
But you know what? One thing science will not prevent, apparently, people getting smarter. For example, yes. You had one cadet swallowed her comm badge. Which I will say, dude, I fucking laughed.
I did too.
And then the same actress, towards the end of the episode, when they were under attack, was just in shock, repeating, red alert, red alert, red alert. The show does have a good balance so far. Yeah,
it does have a really good balance. I mean, like, I like all of the things that they're trying to do with the alien races that may seem strange to a lot of people, but when you think about it and take a step back, scientifically, it works. You know, the idea of crossbreeding, you know, with a lot of like some of the characters are actually hybrids of races. It makes sense.
That does make sense.
Because of crossbreeding. It happens in the real world. And
why is crossbreeding sound so wrong? It sounds a little racial.
And that's the thing is like, I see so many people going crazy about like what they're doing to the alien races. I'm like, no. Scientifically, this makes sense. You know, like the Jem'Hadar crossing over with a Klingon. If the Jem'Hadar actually got past, and they should have, evolved past that issues that they've had since the Dominion War, 900 years, yeah, that race should have changed. Because if you look at humanity, you know, we have changed. If you compare like humanity 900 years away from today, totally different.
Yeah. I mean, it would make sense. I mean, there was a book I read years ago from, he was a Mexican philosopher, Jose Vasconcelos, I believe is how you say his name. And he wrote something called La Raza Cosmica, which is the cosmic race. And
I've heard of that.
And he talked about how we are so upset. This was back in 1925, I believe. And he was talking in great detail about this obsession with race and how the normal human trajectory is for there to be no race, because as time progresses and borders become less and less barriers,
mm-hmm.
you know, with immigration and the rise of multiculturalism and cultural assimilation in some cultures, that there would be no distinct races. We'd all just be one race. And that's one thing that I took away from Starfleet Academy. is that they were very clear in their view in that regard. It was the same idea that after 900 and some years, or not even 900, what, 1400 years of exploring space at that point, if you take into account the original series timeline as well, and the further you leave Earth and the more you're settling other planets and you're living day in, day out with other alien species, of course you would start having relations and children and procreating with other species. So,
and you,
the hybrid races in Starfleet Academy, I think, is not only logical, it works it from works. A narrative standpoint.
And like for a lot of like the Star Trek naysayers, it happened in prior Star Trek. Look at Voyager. It happened. We had like, you know, mixed breedings of the races. And it's like, I actually when I watched the episode the second time, I actually really got behind this idea that basically, yes, please continue showing the evolution of all of these races.
And Discovery did it too. The president of the Federation was, I believe, what, half Cardassian
and half human.
Yeah. And then you had the new Vulcan planet.
Oh, I forgot what it's called.
Where they share with Romulans, and they have more half Romulan, half Vulcans running around.
Yeah.
I mean, it all makes sense. So, all right. So we need to close out the show, but I do want to mention, and I'm going to drag this part over for our second discussion on episode two. I want to talk a little bit more in depth about Sam, the first holographic student.
Okay. I'm excited for this one.
Now, I was pleasantly surprised that I liked the character as much as I did. I was very vocal about this character in the trailer. She is completely the opposite than what I had expected. This seems to be our typical trope that we get in Star Trek, that one character that helps you learn and die, or I should say it's that one character where you use them to dissect and deconstruct humanity.
Yes.
You know, the Data, the Spock, the Seven of Nine, the Doctor from Voyager. It seems like this is going to be that character.
Yes.
And that's why I was pleasantly surprised. Because not only is it intriguing in terms of narrative strategy and what they can do for the ongoing Star Trek stories, but she was also, I want to say, one of my favorite characters because she was charming. She was funny. She was interesting.
Yeah.
And also a new species. And we'll talk about this more in depth in our next episode. But just as a preview, a character like this, if you're not careful, can very quickly undermine decades of philosophical discourse about sentience and consciousness as they relate to artificial life. So they have to be careful. It's going to be a tight rope for them to walk, but I'm sure if it's well thought out, they'll be able to do it. We'll get into that more during our next discussion. In fact, I believe we'll start the second episode with that point of discussion. So I was going back and forth. We only have a few minutes, David, left, but okay. I've been going back and forth during our Star Trek hiatus coverage on whether or not we should continue doing scores. And the reason why is because we don't really review anyways. We just discuss. But then when I have always floated that idea, say our listeners quickly take umbrage. Like, no, do not give up the scores. So what do you think we should do, David? Should we continue with the scores, or should we move away from divisiveness and just stick to banter?
I think, here's the thing. I have flip-flop between these two since our hiatus, because scores to me just bring up such divisive nature in people that it just basically makes me not want to talk to people.
The only reason why I may want to keep our score is oftentimes people will listen to a review or discussion that we did on a movie, and people will then be surprised when we give it like a 40% or 50%.
Yes.
Like, well, you just spent an hour talking about what it does. I'm like, yes, we're talking about what it does. We're not talking about values. We're not evaluating it. We're not giving it a pass, you know, fail, pass, grade.
Yeah.
We're discussing it. And just because we can discuss what it does doesn't mean it did it right.
Exactly.
So maybe that might confuse people if we don't. Maybe they want to know how we actually feel because we just discussed. Perhaps people won't get the true thoughts on how we felt about how the episode was in terms of quality.
Yeah.
So,
I do think that now, as I said, I flip-flopped on this. I do think that basically just us doing the scores is actually doing the show justice because,
okay,
in my opinion, at this point, being on hiatus, Mike, and actually just watching the internet evolve, in my opinion, we need to be stalwarts. As I know you always say, I don't want to be a gatekeeper. Nah, now I want to be a gatekeeper. I do. Because
you see a gatekeeper?
A gatekeeper. Well, you know, but we have to do the scores because it gets those trolls angry and hard at us because we're actually doing what they should be doing.
Okay, so I'll keep it simple then. I will give this episode a 72%. Dave?
My score for this is a 78. I gave it a 78%.
Okay. All right. On that note, we're going to close out. We'll be back with our second episode discussion shortly.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.